You've seen the headlines. Bonds are making a comeback. But if you've ever tried to invest in bonds, you know what a clunky, complicated, broken experience it can be. That's why at Public, they took fixed income and fixed it. Now you can find, evaluate, and buy thousands of bonds with an investing experience designed this century. Add fixed income to your portfolio with corporate, treasury, and municipal bonds. Go to public.com/bondspodcast to get started. This podcast is sponsored by Public. Full disclosures can be found at public.com/bonds. Chat with Traders is sponsored by Trade the Pool. Are concerns about limited buying power, insufficient capital, or fear of losing your own money preventing you from advancing your trading capabilities? Trade the Pool is an online stock trading prop firm that offers funding for stock traders. Demonstrate your skills, trade their capital, and keep your profits. You can engage in intraday trading and now swing trading on Trade the Pool with any U.S. stock or ETF. The procedure is straightforward. Pay an evaluation fee, successfully complete the evaluation, and get funded. Visit tradethepool.com/chat to learn more.
Markets, speculation, and risk. This is the Chat with Traders podcast, hosted by Aaron Fifield.
Hey, ladies and gents. Thank you for joining me on the first episode of 2018. Let's make this a good year. Now, the feature of this episode is an interview I did with Michael Katz. Michael is an active day trader and swing trader, and he's also the managing partner slash co-founder of a New York City prop firm, Seven Points Capital. One of the things which struck me about Michael is the sheer amount of volume which he trades, which is most impressive due to the fact that he's trading by hand without the assistance of algorithms. In addition to trading big volume, I ask Mike to discuss things such as the strategies and setups which he trades, both momentum and scalping, with access to thousands of stocks, how he decides where to focus his attention each day, his secrets to consistency, because Mike has been green every month for the past 3 years and possibly longer. And as we're starting a new year, I felt it was appropriate to ask Mike, what are three things that traders can do to increase their likelihood of trading success in 2018? So if you've been spinning your wheels, this is for you. Enjoy the episode, you good folks. I'm Aaron Fifield. With me is Michael Katz. Christmas, New Year's, etc.
Holiday was great. Lots of cold up here in New York, so we ended up staying in for New Year's. But it was nice. The kids stayed up, and some family came over, and ended up being a blast.
Very nice. How many kids do you have?
I got three. Three kids, two boys and a girl. I call it two bodyguards and a girl. and they're growing up fast, man. And we got this nice big snowstorm here now that nobody was really expecting.
All right.
I ended up staying in home today. Figured I'll work from home. So that kind of worked out. Traded a little bit in the morning and now pretty much ready to go.
Okay. How'd you been? It was good. I mean, I guess my Christmas and New Year was very different. It was stinking hot here in Australia, or in Brisbane particularly. But anyway, let's waste no time. Let's get stuck into this. What is your story? Like, how did you get started in trading?
So I got started in trading like most people do, right? Back in late 90s, I was, you know, in my late teens and I kept on hearing from my friends about all these internet stocks that were going up. And for a while, I said, I don't know what that is, what the market is. But it just kept on hearing over and over from all my friends who kept on making lots of money in the market. And so I decided to kind of look into it. And then basically, I started doing some research, started asking friends. And I ended up opening a small account. A few thousand dollars back then, trading those dot-com stocks that, you know, went crazy throughout the bubble. And obviously, I blew up a couple of accounts real early, real fast. But, you know, started learning and definitely got more and more interested in the markets and what it had to offer. So I started searching for people who, you know, might be able to teach me what I should be looking at. So I came across a firm, Equity Trading Online, and it was run by a guy called Gary Roth, who was given these lessons on how to trade. And so I attended and I really got hooked right away. And I decided that I want to be a trader right then and there.
I've been keen to ask someone who was trading actively during that dot-com era, do you see any comparisons from the dot-com period to what we're seeing currently in the space of cryptocurrencies?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. Definitely a lot of parallels. Everything's moving with crazy volatility, lots of, you know, unexplainable moves, both in these coins and some of the symbols that just, you know, these companies that all of a sudden announced that they have something to do with crypto, or they just added blockchain to their name and all of a sudden the stock goes up 500%, right? We see that every day. So a lot of parallels like that as far as, you know, unexplainable moves where people who know what they're doing are being a little bit more careful and probably missing out on some of these moves. And then you have the average individual that, you know, knows a little bit less and is willing to take on blind risk, and, you know, they're probably crushing it. And those are the parallels that I'm seeing. And, you know, I get phone calls from people all the time, you know, asking me about these coins. And honestly, crazy moves, lots of big gains people are having, but while I do trade them, I'm very skeptical, and you know, I'm very short term in them.
Do you think there are any differences though? Like, you know, obviously I asked you if you see any similarities between both of these things, but do you also see some big differences?
The main difference I see is that in the dot-com bubble, the move started on Wall Street. Everything started on Wall Street. And then when retail got involved, when mom and pops got involved, you know, they caught the tail end of it. They had some good times, but eventually they got hurt when the crash happened, right? I think with the crypto world, what's going on is you have a lot of retail that's driving it initially, whereas you don't have the Wall Street support and you don't have a lot of the big trader support. And then now we're, you know, Wall Street is starting to get into the space. So that's the main difference I see. And I'm not sure how that plays out as far as, you know, is it a bubble? Is there, you know, is it going to crash? That's the only difference I see, because most big firms, you know, they're not going to want to put up $1 million bucks or $10 million bucks with, you know, some unknown exchange somewhere. And so I think that's been holding Wall Street back a little bit.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because I mean, when you put it like that, it's pretty much the exact opposite to how it was with the dot-com stocks, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I remember when I was trading back then, I would come in and towards the end of it, you know, in the trading firm, I'd have all kinds of people sitting next to me, people that were traders for a long time. And then all of a sudden, you know, the cab driver and you know, the moms and the pops just sitting next to me and putting up capital and trading back then. And it was wild. There were some crazy moves, a lot of, you know, a lot of volatility and good trading. But, you know, that was the end of it when that happened. So I'm also trying to draw these parallels in Bitcoin and coins in general. And there are some parallels, but the differences right now, I think, are still there. The key will be to see if there is really any value add with the cryptocurrencies. And I'm just really on the lookout. I'm trading them, but I'm always in the back of my head thinking, okay, you know, there could be a big crash right around the corner.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably a healthy mindset, is to be a little bit skeptical.
It's not going to take a lot, right? Either the government cracks down or the SEC says these are not, you know, you can't trade these. These are completely securities. So it won't take a lot to get a big move. But at the same time, you know, you can't miss out. You got to be involved.
That's it. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it is very bizarre times. Like we had a few people around our place for New Year's Eve, and Yeah, I was getting asked questions about Bitcoin and, well, mostly Bitcoin actually, some of the other cryptos, but it was just like people who have no interest in it. And these are more like sort of, you know, my girlfriend's friends, partners and all that, who sort of have a little bit of an idea on what I do. And yeah, it was kind of bizarre to be having those conversations with people like that. But anyway, it is what it is. So you said that you blew up a couple accounts early on. Was that during the dot-com era? Like, were you still trying to go long as these stocks were all crashing? Or what led to you blowing up those few accounts in the early days?
Yeah, exactly. So on the way up, things were easy. Everybody's making money. It wasn't a matter of if you were making money. It was just how much risk were you willing to put on and how much money were you going to make on the long side, right? It was just a play of, well, what am I going to buy tonight? So it gaps up overnight. And money was easy. But then when the market crashed, there was a huge whoosh to the downside. And, you know, beginning trader, I didn't know what I was doing. And risk management was obviously very poor. And I ended up writing things down as they went lower and adding to losing positions. And, you know, when the bounce didn't come, it was just a matter of getting margined out and reloading and the same thing happening again. So the key was obviously in hindsight to minimize the losses, but back then, you know, I was definitely not thinking that way.
Okay. So walk us through maybe the few years which followed on from then. Like, what happened between kind of where we're at now in terms of your career and what happened, yeah, between then and now where you've started 7 Points Capital?
Sure. So I feel like I'm very fortunate to have been in that position when, after I blew up a couple of accounts, we had the technology at that trading firm where, you know, back then everybody was placing orders through their phone calls and calling the brokers and paying crazy commissions. And, you know, the specialists and the market makers were always screwing them on their orders. So when we had the technology and we used to go to their desktop and say, hey, I can offer you a trading platform. I can cut your commission in half and basically give you an edge. I decided I'm going to become a broker and start pitching some of these hedge funds and institutions, these trading platforms that were fairly new back then. And that bought me probably a few years worth of a window where I was still involved in the market. I was still doing very well as a broker, and allowed me to get screen time and continue to learn what works and what doesn't work in the market. And, you know, still losing money as a trader early on, but it allowed me to continue to learn, and the screen time, I think, was key.
So at what point did 7 Points Capital start to kick off? Like, how did that come about?
So when we were executing customer orders, working orders, we started developing a very good understanding of the microstructure in the equity space, understanding what's involved in you know, executing orders, specifically large orders. And we started dealing with these floor brokers that on the New York Stock Exchange. And one of them gave us an idea of how to trade a certain edge that they had on the floor back then. The NYSE gave them an edge called parity so that they won't go out of business due to electronic trading. And we started trading that way and we realized, hey, there's something here. There's clearly an edge. And we took that and I said, all right, I'm going to start focusing on this, start applying some of the skills I've learned over the years as a trader and started trading and very quickly saw good results. And it then was just a matter of, okay, let's go out and go from just me and one other guy doing it to bringing on one more person and grow from 1 to 2. And when that worked out really well, we went from 2 to 4 and so on and so forth and kept on growing that way. And before you know it, you know, 7 Points Capital, we decided we're no longer going to be executing customer business, because the commissions were getting very skinny and we were just doing very well on the trading side. And the partners, well, back then I mentioned Gary Roth, who has since passed away a couple of years ago, who was a fantastic individual. And Mike Mangieri and myself, we were running 7 Points. And Mike Mangieri, a brilliant guy who's really good at running companies, running personalities, and dealing with individuals, has basically was pushing us to say, let's go, let's start trading more and focus less on the commission side. And before you know it, we turned into a trading firm.
Would you mind just explaining what is parity trading? I'm not really familiar with that.
So parity trading, the advantage was that if you have a thick quote in a low price stock, let's say back then Citibank was really active, there used to be a million shares on the bid. And with parity trading, you used to be able to buy on the bid through the floor brokers and get a good early fill and collect a small rebate and just constantly make a market. And that's as close as you're going to get to a zero risk trade, right? Where if I'm able to buy on the bid when there's quite a bit on the bid, then I can either scratch when I see that the stock's going down and hit the bid and break even, or I can make money if it goes up.
So it essentially gave you like priority in the queue position.
Exactly. And the market was so dislocated and still is to this day that basically any flow that went to the New York Stock Exchange, we used to be able to trade with while other market centers were just waiting there to get the fill.
That seems like a pretty big advantage to have.
I would think so. I would think so. It definitely is a big advantage. But since then, it started diminishing because the NYSE kept on losing order flow as more and more people wanted to go electronic. And all these other exchanges and dark pools popped up, less and less would go to the NYSE. So they started losing that edge there.
Okay. Now, so how has your edge evolved today? Like, can you describe to us what sort of strategies you and also your firm are trading nowadays?
Sure. So we took that and we were able to expand it and develop some market making strategies with similar concepts in mind. And in addition, we trade quite a bit of momentum strategy. So those are the two umbrellas that they will fall underneath. I probably trade about 15 different setups on a given day. And for example, on the momentum side, we're trading setups where I'm looking to join trend and look for certain patterns where we've seen these patterns before and we have rules developed around these patterns and how to trade them. And we'll look to join trend and capitalize on a move once it's already in force. On the market making side, it's, you know, mean reversion types of strategies, having the ability to execute on different dark pools, exchanges, market makers, not have to pay a commission, which is the structure at Seven Points Capital, gives us the huge edge to be able to trade very heavy and scale size whenever we see fit.
What do you mean by not pay commission? How do you get around that?
So that's part of the difference at Seven Points Capital, I'd say. At Seven Points Capital, when we started out as an executing firm and the trading was kind of a side thing. And that grew into a pretty big business. But the model initially was, let's bring in traders, let's back them, let's not charge them commissions because, you know, we don't pay a commission as a firm. So it's our capital, no commissions, no training fee and things like that. And it's just a matter of if the trader makes money, then the firm does well.
But you as a firm, you still have fees and you still don't have commissions as a firm?
So we have a very tiny clearing fee, which we pay our clearing firm, but we don't even pass that to the traders. And, you know, as far as different exchanges and different trading venues, they could have either rebates or fees, which gets passed through.
Yeah, right. Would you mind talking a little bit more about how you're using dark pools? You mentioned it just briefly before. Let's go into that a little more. Like, what advantage do you have by having access to dark pools and how do you use them?
The advantage that we have using dark pools, I'd say, well, first of all, we connect to most dark pools out there, right? So whether it's the big banks or the executing medium-sized brokerage firms that are ones that are executing large order flow, we connect to them. And when we see the order flow and the tape, printing a certain way. What we could do is we try to throw out feelers and see where these prints are taking place. And a lot of times we're able to interact with large block buyers or sellers, and that gives us good liquidity. So if I'm in a situation where I know I've seen this pattern before, let's take, for example, something that's trending up and is now dipping into support, pulling back into support. And I want to be able to get involved on the long side, joining the trend at a very specific spot at support. I want to be able to put on as much size as possible, because that's a very low risk trade if I keep my stop close, right? So the dark pools are able to give us this advantage where we can get in and interact with some of the bigger traders and bypass some of the HFTs.
But is there not more volume traded on the actual like lit exchanges?
I would say these days, yes, there's a decent amount on the lit exchanges. A lot of it gets internalized by the market makers, the large ones like the Citadels of the world. And a decent amount also goes through the dark pools as well.
Okay, so how come you're able to put on larger positions by going through a dark pool than you would going through a lit exchange?
Because it could be that on the other side, the counterparty that I'm trading with saying, I don't want to trade with anything less than 50,000 shares. So they have a minimum quantity on their order. And most HFTs, you know, they're buying, selling 100 shares all day long. They're not going to interact with that. Most retail is not going to interact with that. So the institutions want to be able to trade with large players to get the order flow done without too much information leakage.
Okay. And having access to these dark pools, that's one of the advantages, I'd presume, of trading with a prop firm, right?
Yes, I would think so. So having access to multiple trading venues is definitely an edge that we have. Other advantages of trading at a prop firm, I would say, is depending on the commission structure, maybe a commission edge. Getting good locates is definitely a big edge. Being able to borrow stock that might not be available through your typical E-Trade and retail type of brokerage firms. Let's see, other edge I'd say is just being around good traders that want to share ideas, want to go over their day together with the guy next to them and see what they did well and what they did poorly and what they want to improve on. I would say those are the main advantages to trading at a prop firm.
You've seen the headlines. Bonds are making a comeback. But if you've ever tried to invest in bonds, you know what a clunky, complicated, broken experience it can be. That's why at Public, they took fixed income and fixed it. Now you can find, evaluate, and buy thousands of bonds with an investing experience designed this century. They started at the beginning, reimagining the bond screener with an intuitive design that helps you zero in on the exact kinds of bonds you're looking for. Then they made it easier to evaluate each investment opportunity with better data in the places you need it most. Finally, they made investing in bonds as straightforward as stocks or any other asset. Add fixed income to your portfolio with corporate, treasury, and municipal bonds. Go to public.com/bondspodcast to get started. This podcast is sponsored by Public. Full disclosures can be found at public.com/bonds.
Are you a developing or seasoned day trader who trades the U.S. markets? Is the only thing stopping you from getting to the next level is having enough capital to trade? Trade the Pool is a unique online stock trading prop firm that funds stock traders worldwide. Not having to risk your own capital can help you focus on other things like making better decisions on your trades. There's no PDT rules to worry about. You got more than 12,000 stocks and ETFs to trade, long or short, and professional tools at your side. How you get funded is you show them your skills through a straightforward evaluation process. Once you pass the evaluation, you get funded and trade with their pool of money and split the profits. Don't let the lack of buying power, capital, or fear of losing your own money prevent you from taking your trading to the next level. Visit tradethepool.com/chat to learn more.
Now, I'd like to go into hear a bit more about your actual marketing strategies, because if I understand right, You guys actually do very little automation there. I would have thought that makes it very difficult to run market making types of strategies in US equity markets.
So the market making strategies are going to work on very specific types of symbols. We're not going to do a whole lot of that in some very high-flying names like NVIDIA and Apples of the world. Those symbols, I'd rather join trend and try to capitalize on a move, take a lot smaller size and capitalize on potential big move that's unfolding, right? On the market making side, it's probably, you know, a lower price name doing a lot of volume, might have like a 20, 30, 50 cent range on the day. And you can go in there and trade size, know that you have liquidity. I can easily buy whatever I want to buy and sell whatever I want to sell without really moving the market too much.
So what would be an example of some stocks which you would consider a market making strategy?
I mean, these days you have a lot of these names like the AMDs of the world, anything that's, you know, between $5 and $20 and doing at least 10 million shares a day, that's going to be a good candidate for that.
And so what would be your time frame on those trades?
So on those particular trades, the time frame is probably, I'd say, minutes to an hour. Whereas some of the other trades we trade, you know, hour to a few days.
So what would define it as a market making strategy though? Like, you're obviously posting liquidity.
I guess market making strategy is just what we kind of call it internally, but it's, if you want to just call it scalping, where you're in and out, decent size, sometimes adding liquidity, sometimes taking liquidity, and trying to capture a piece of a range.
Right. And you said your trading also consists of a lot of momentum trading as well. If you had to kind of break it down, what percentage would you say, you know, of your own P&L comes from these strategies which you classify as market making strategies compared to momentum? Like, where is the bulk of your P&L coming from?
If you asked me that question a few years ago, it would be a lot more on the market making side and the scalping side and less on the momentum. But I'd say today, myself and the firm as a whole, a whole lot more is being traded on the momentum, pattern recognition, technical analysis, and short-term catalysts. That's where most of our profits come from these days. We still do a decent amount of scalping and market making, but less and less. Just so much opportunity out there in some of these low cap names that are moving, you know, 500 or 1,000% in very short periods of time, or a large cap name like, you know, like an Apple or like an Intel that, you know, has a catalyst, either a fresh piece of news that we can trade for 2-3 days and move on to the next one.
Right. Okay. Now, one of the things which really stuck out to me when I was doing a bit of preparation for this interview is the amount of volume that you're trading yourself. You know, I think, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think about on average, you're doing about 50 million shares per month, which seems like an awful lot. How are you able to trade, you know, on average, about 50 million shares per month as a click trader?
So I think a lot of it has to do with edge, reading order flow, having confidence in what I'm doing, and it's the actual method of how we trade, you know, hotkeys and having direct market access, connections to all these different places, allows us to really size in when we see opportunity and take advantage of it. So, yeah, it's a lot of shares, and, you know, that's kind of the goal of every trader. You know, you want to keep growing and pushing it as much as possible until you kind of see it that, you know, you've reached a max of what you can accomplish.
So how are you able to get so much size on though?
Well, a lot of it is not going to be at just one price, right? So it's a lot of scaling in and scaling out at different prices, accumulating shares and scaling out, I'd say.
Yeah. Okay. Well, talk to us a little bit about that. Like, how are you scaling in? How are you scaling out? Like, adding, reducing size. Like, how do you think about that sort of thing?
It's kind of tough. So the way I approach trading is, let's say I mentioned before, we have 15 different setups, right? Each one of those setups is going to have its own rules of how I first look for the setup, how I'm going to put the trade on, whether I'm going to scale in or put it on one shot, where my stop goes, how much I'm going to put on, how much I'm going to put on in a very high conviction situation. So each one of those setups will have its own rules that I have written down on paper in my Evernote. And, you know, every day I will measure my performance, not just on the P&L, but also on whether or not I was able to follow my rules. And I think that's the big differentiator right there.
I don't know if this is too much, but would you mind sharing one of those setups?
Sure. So let's see. A setup that I personally like to trade, and those who have seen our YouTube videos, at the end of the day, I go over this one quite a bit, is like a descending triangle in a low cap trash name, right? So when a low cap stock goes up, you know, a few 100%, and finally starts to stall out and puts in lower high and showing that it's now on the backside, I'm looking for a certain pattern. And that would be a descending triangle, meaning that it had a dip, and the next time it came back up, it made a lower high. And when it had the next dip, it's starting to look like a triangle, right? And on that scenario, I know that I have three ways I'm going to enter that setup. One is within the triangle. The other one is when it breaks. And then the third one is if it comes back to retest a breakout level. So each one of those will have a rule and say, okay, when I get in here, I'm going to risk X dollars. And then my stop goes above that high. And so very specific, very methodical. And every day when I see these setups, I will take a screenshot, send it to my Evernote. And that way it stays fresh in my mind. And my confidence grows whenever I do that, right? If I've seen a setup 1,000 times, and, you know, I know what the win rate's going to be. I know what to expect. I know what it's going to look like when it's about to fail. And I know where I need to really size in and take advantage of a good opportunity.
Now, something like that, are you taking this trade every time you see a setup which fits that criteria? Or are you kind of selective about which ones you actually execute on?
So if it meets my criteria, and it's setting up as that particular setup, I have to take it. If I don't take it, then I'm just adding a lot more variation to the results. And, you know, that's just going to cause frustration. So I'm going to try to take that setup every time I see it. Now, do I do it every time? There are times where, you know, you're a little bit more gun shy, maybe because you're not running as well, or you might jump the gun where that setup hasn't really fully presented itself yet. And, you know, it's been used going a little bit earlier, but, if I see it, I'm going to take it. And then at the end of the day, I'm going to measure how I did. Did I go in too early, or did I completely miss the trade, and why did I miss it?
Mm. So just going back to, the volume that you're trading, I guess I still have a couple questions around that. And this might take a little bit of explaining about how things work in the US equity market, but how much of your P&L, or how much does rebate contribute to your P&L? Like, is that a big part of your strategy?
No, not anymore. I think it's there and it's useful to have access to that, but it's not the driver these days. These days, the HFTs who are co-located and have fast connections and best hardware, and the special order types, those guys are going to be there much earlier than me. So just trading for the rebates, that game is done, unless you're, you know, one of the best HFT guys out there. Now, it doesn't mean that I don't trade for rebates. You know, I don't try to be efficient and maximize what I could get, but we don't specifically trade for rebates. That's not a big part of what we do.
Okay. What sort of stocks are you trading? I know you spoke about this a little bit before, and that setup you gave, you spoke about trash names, which I'm sure are mostly the lower cap stocks. But where is most of your volume done? Is it done on these big blue chip names where you can really get a lot of size on, or is it done mostly in low floats?
I'd say it's probably a third in these low price stocks that you could do a lot of volume, blue chip names, you could do a lot of volume. And then the other third would be these low cap stocks.
And how many names would you be in and out of on any given day? Like, how many stocks are you watching?
I'd probably trade about 8-10 names on any given day. And some of those might be, you know, something I'm swinging for a few days or a couple of weeks, or and I'm trading around a core position, while others I'm just, you know, something with fresh news that, you know, short-term trading, and I'm in it, in and out, and probably putting on 5-10 trades in that symbol.
So how are you deciding if a trade is going to be just a short-term intraday trade or something that you might swing for a couple of days?
Most of the time when I put the trade on, I already know if this is something I want to swing. It's setting up as a swing trade in a different time frame. For example, in a 15-minute chart, on a 1-minute chart, on a 1-hour chart rather, I already know that this is something that if it keeps on acting like it should, I'll take it home, and I'd want to keep it for, you know, a few days, a couple of weeks, if it keeps acting right.
So what might be a reason for you to swing? Like you say, if it looks like it's, you usually know when you put a trade on, how long you're going to hold that stock for, presuming it keeps acting how you anticipate it to act. What would give you reason to think that this is a good trade to swing for a few days?
It's simple, right? In this business, it's mostly about green or red. And if I put on a swing position and it's working, the earlier it works, the better. And by the end of the day, if it's green and it's working, then I'm going to keep that one and allow my exit rules to take over. You know, in this business, it's a lot of black and white. It's very easy to know when you're wrong, and it's very easy to know when you're right. It's not like when you open a retail store, you might need 6 months to figure out if the business model is working. You know instantly that the trade that you put on, if it's right or wrong, and the best trades will start working right away.
Mm. And these 8-10 names that you're trading, you know, on average most days, how are you finding these 8-10 names? Like, out of all the stocks you can pick from in the US market, how do you decide that these are a good 8 names to be trading for this day?
Yeah, so when we get in early, we'll start doing research. First of all, see on the macro picture what's going on. Any news overnight overseas that might have moved markets or could potentially move markets. So do the research early as far as what's in the news, any macro themes that we need to be aware of. And then in the morning, whatever's gapping, whatever's got a piece of news, a catalyst that might move a stock up or down and make it gap, we're interested in that. And then during the day, we'll use scanners that are looking for specific criteria that once it's met, it spits out a symbol and says, here, look at this one. This is a criteria we're looking for.
What's some of the criteria that you might put into a scanner, just as an idea?
Volume, volatility, range on a day, float, mainly those are fresh news.
Now these eight, I keep saying eight stocks, but give or take, these names that you're trading each day, is it often the case that particularly if you're trading a catalyst, that these eight stocks or however many stocks are tightly, I don't know if correlated is the right word, but tightly linked, like in the same sector?
No, they don't have to be. For example, I could be trading Intel. Like yesterday, I had some fresh news about, you know, their security problems that they're going to have with their chips. So that was really active yesterday. I was trading one semiconductor name, and in the level two right next to it, I could be trading, you know, a blockchain name, something that just moves because they got a mention in the cryptocurrency space.
Right. And your entries on these trades, what are they based on? I know you've talked a little bit about using technical analysis. Is that what actually determines your entry? Is that how you time your entries, or are you looking at the order book, or is there something else to it?
For me, a lot of those come together. So I would say it's reading the tape and order flow, technical analysis, good understanding of charts and volume. And for me, volume is very important. And in addition to that, I'd say what's moving the stock, what's the catalyst. And then if it's something that I've seen in the past that I've kind of encountered it to behave a certain way, when that catalyst comes out, that also plays into it.
When you say volume is important, can you just flesh that out a little more? Like, what do you like to see in the volume?
Two main things, and I'd recommend individuals who are interested about learning more about volume, the book by Anna Cooling, Volume Price Analysis. For me, that helped quite a bit, because I always knew the volume was important, and I just could never really understand and put my finger on exactly what I wanted to see until I read that book, and she kind of clears it up pretty well. So volume, with how it's displaying itself between different bars as the bars unfold and as the chart unfolds, how different volume patterns develop with different chart patterns. And what I specifically like quite a bit is volume profile, where the volume is displayed on the side axis and showing me not just the price, but how much volume traded at different price levels.
Okay, that's interesting, because is that uncommon for equity traders to be using volume profile? Typically, when I hear about volume profile, it's usually coming from someone who trades futures, right?
Yeah, I think it's more common in the futures world, and I think we spend a decent amount talking about equity trades, but we do trade quite a bit of equities, futures, options, and pretty much all the products out there. But I would say that it probably did start in the futures world, and the reason I like to use it is it gives more context to support and resistance levels. So turning points on a chart are more important than if there's a lot of volume that traded on at that level, if that makes sense.
No, it does. It does. Mike, one of the things I'd like to speak with you about, actually, there's a couple other big things I'd like to talk to you about. The first being consistency, right? So for the past 3 years, I'm pretty sure you've been green every month. Now, that's quite an achievement. What's your secret to consistency?
Great question. I think consistency is what is really going to differentiate the great traders from the ones who are just going to get lucky here and there. So what does it take to be consistent? I'd say, first of all, you got to have a clear and definable edge. Then you got to always minimize your bad losses and just avoid those big losses that, you know, take a big chunk of your account that might take some time to work back. So, which is why I kind of scale back when I'm not running well, when my trading is not doing too well. I'll scale back. I'll risk maybe half or a quarter of what I risk on average, and I'll do less when I'm not thinking clearly, when I'm not performing well, or I'll really scale up and put some serious size on and multiples of what I usually risk whenever I'm in the zone and whenever I'm thinking clearly and the market's lining up with what I'm thinking as well. So just being able to throttle the risk that I put on, I think, is important. And then risk management is pretty much everything. I know a lot of your guests do mention that quite a bit, and you know, I can't stress it enough. Risk management is king, right?
So what are some of the things you do to manage risk? Like, obviously you mentioned a few there, but can you go into that a little more? Like, what are some of the, maybe the big takeaways which you could share about, you know, some of the things you do on how to manage risk?
Sure. So before I put any trade on, I already know where I'll be getting out if it starts to go against me. I think that's a big one, right? if you compare any retail trader to a professional trader, I'd say that's probably one of the main differentiators, where retail, when I say retail, I mean just, you know, someone who very new to the markets, not necessarily, you know, retail traders, but they, you know, they put trades on, they're just hoping for the best. And if you ask them, well, what do you think is, what are you going to do if a trade doesn't go your way? They never even thought about it, right? So I like to make sure I know where I'm getting out before I even get in. And by doing that, I'm able to also figure out how much to put on, because I want to risk a fixed amount, a fixed dollar amount on every trade, right? And in order to do that, I first have to know where I'm going to get out when I'm wrong. So that allows me to also size my positions correctly. Okay. So I think those are really important. The stop loss, focusing on where I get out, where does the pattern fall apart, is where my stop belongs, right? If I'm in a pattern, if I'm in a trade because of a specific pattern, then my stop needs to be outside of the pattern, where if the stock or the future or whatever, if it goes there, then the pattern is no longer valid. So you got to know before you put the trade on where you're getting out.
Yeah. And another thing you mentioned just before was reducing size when you're not performing as well as you could be. How do you, this might sound like a silly question and maybe an obvious, that would have an obvious answer, but how do you know when you're not performing well? Like, is that after you've taken a large hit, or is it anticipation that you might be due for a large hit? Like, when you might just come in one day and you might not be in sync with markets, you know, things just aren't working out. Do you feel like you're out of touch at the moment and you should reduce your size before something bad happens? Like, how do you know when you should be trading less size?
That's fantastic, fantastic question, because it's very easy to kind of blur the lines between, you know, be aggressive, be confident, and stay the course versus, you know, pushing it too hard and just being stubborn, right? So the way I know that I need to size down is usually when I'm breaking my rules. So every one of my setups, as I mentioned, has all the rules I need to trade that setup from beginning of the trade till the end, right? When I start to break my rules, that's usually a sign that I'm not thinking clearly, I'm not performing at my peak level, and that's usually coinciding with P&L also, you know, not being there. So I think that's a big trigger for me to size down. But a lot of times, you know, you can't tell right away, especially when you're in the trade. You know, it might take a few losses. It might take, you know, a few rules broken before you realize that you need to size down. You need to slow down, maybe take a break, take a walk, take a day off, and come back. But yeah, I would say the rule breaking is definitely a big one.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's a good point to note. Yeah, that's a good answer. And one of the other, or the first key you mentioned, first secret to your consistency, was having a clear, definable edge. So how do you think about an edge as a discretionary trader? Like, to you, what does it mean to have an edge? Because I think I've spoken about this on a previous episode, but I think, like, someone who might be more of a quantitative algorithmic trader is going to think about edge differently to someone who's more of a discretionary trader. So, you know, the way you see it, how do you think about an edge?
That's definitely an ambiguous word, right? The way I see edge is anything that I can do or I have access to that most people do not or can't do. I think that's an edge, right? So if I'm able to take losses quickly and have good risk management, where that really goes against human nature and most people can't do that, I consider that an edge. If I'm able to execute and have access to multiple dark pools and you know, read the tape and have good order flow management. I should say actually order flow reading. That's an edge too, right? I'm able to have my finger on the pulse of the symbol, the pulse of the market, and I'm able to kind of become one with the symbol. That's really the best place I want to be, right? Where I can read the signs that the stock's telling me as opposed to just ignore it and bring my own opinions. So being an order flow trader, being a pattern trader, and seeing where things don't act like they should allows me to kind of get a feel for what's going on. And a busted pattern, I think, is a good way to kind of reverse and go the other way, because obviously what you were thinking is not working. So I think an edge is all those things. It's tough to define, but it's got to be something that is not readily accessible to everybody.
And it's largely based on your setups as well, right?
Yes. And the setups and the experience of seeing it before, right? I'm a big fan of journaling. And all our traders, you know, they journal and they have to email myself and some of the other senior traders every night. Yeah, the trades that they did and why they did it, and were they able to follow their rules? Do they have to tweak their rules? And I'm a big proponent of journaling. It forces you to go back and review what you did. Mm. And I think anytime you're doing anything competitive, whether it's sports or trading or poker, whatever it is, the idea is you got to have a plan going in. You got to try to execute your plan during the game. And then at the end, after the game, you go back, you watch tape, and you try to review what you did well and what you might want to tweak for the next game. So I think journaling is huge.
Yeah. This is perhaps a question I should have asked you a little earlier, but these setups that you're trading, how have you come to identify those setups? Like, where did they come from? Was it just purely from screen time, or was it from deliberate research? How have you come to identify these setups as having an edge?
I would say that over time, you start to develop a trading method where you're grabbing things from here and from there, and you're kind of putting together your strategy, your setups, but you could get little nuances from different places, right? So I love watching, you know, traders on YouTube. That's like, you know, that's like my Netflix, where I want to see what other people are doing. It doesn't mean I'm going to trade that way, but I always try to learn something from someone, whether it's the guy sitting next to me or the guy on YouTube. And I can't say enough about how much I've learned from your podcasts. I always want to try to get as much as I can from everywhere. But I still have to bring it back and make it my own and add it to my way of trading. And I never want to follow anybody else. I never want to put a trade on just because somebody else said so. It's got to be my own. But I'm willing to learn from everywhere I could learn from.
Yeah, I really like that. And I think that's so important, is to make ideas your own, or like to come up with your own ideas. Like, you can take influence and ideas from other people, but ultimately you need to make it your own. Like, I'm often surprised by some of the emails I get. You know, people are asking, like, who's a good person to learn from? And I never suggest anyone. I mean, yeah, I feel like you've sort of got to come up with your own ideas, test them. It's not just like a matter of watching someone and then just replicating exactly what they do, right?
Absolutely. I mean, what works for me, a very specific way, somebody else trying to replicate the exact same setup with the exact same rules, even if they have it written down on paper in front of them, it's not going to work for them, because I might have traded this setup, you know, 100 times, and it's evolved over time, and I've made my tweaks, and throughout time my confidence has grown in it, and you know, I journal it, and next time I see it, because I've journaled it, because I've taken a screenshot, and because I've reviewed what I've done, the next time I see it, my confidence is going to be that much higher, and I'll see it much earlier than the guy next to me who's never even traded the setup before. So that's why I think following others and doing something because others are doing, it's not going to work because your confidence in it is going to be very low. And what's going to happen is the first time you're going to take a loss, and everybody takes losses, right? The first time you're going to take a loss, you're just going to scrap it. You're going to think, it's not working. It's not moving averages that I have to be focused on. It's MACD or it's stochastic or it's volume profile or whatever the next hot thing is, right?
Yeah. No, I completely agree. Mike, just to take us out here, I said a little earlier, there was two big things I wanted to talk to you about. One of them was being consistency. The other one is, you know, I feel like this is an appropriate question given the time of the year we're at. Let's say for someone who, you know, they know the basics about trading, okay? They're not a complete newbie, but they've been spinning their wheels, right? They haven't really been making much progress over the past year or two. They feel like 2018 is going to be the year where they start to succeed as a trader. What would you say are some of the best things they could do to give them the best shot of making that happen? These might be basic things, but, you know, things which you feel might be fundamental for a developing trader to do.
That's a great question. I wish I came across your podcast like 10 years before I did. I would have done better earlier. But I'd say the first thing has to be set rules for each setup. Don't leave anything for emotion, and know what you want to do before you even start, right? Have a business plan for each setup. It's extremely important. The other thing I'd say is surround yourself with good, smart people. If you're a retail guy and trading from home, you might be on Skype, in a group chat with other good traders. If you're looking for a firm, look for a good firm that has good traders and a good setup. So surround yourself with good people that are genuinely going to teach you and work with you and mentor you on how to trade. I think that's big. And be careful because, you know, these days, you know, Twitter is fantastic and YouTube, all that is great. But I think that some people might fall into the trap of following some guru that, you know, has a trading room or has a DVD, just buy my DVD and, you know, you'll do well, or just let me, you know, mirror my trades and things like that. So you got to be careful with that. It's still got to come back and be your own trades. You know, you see all these guys on Twitter and all over. Some of them are, you know, I'm sure are pretty good, but for everyone that's good and really trading, there might be, you know, 10 that's just looking to sell you something. So just be aware of that, and you know, it just feel your trades. You know, when I have positions on and I have a couple of traders shadowing me as they're learning, that feels real, right? And that's the way I see it, and learning from someone where you can actually see what's going on is huge, as opposed to just following someone else. I think that's very important. So have rules. Be careful who you follow. There are some really great traders out there that are doing some great things. You know, a buddy of mine smashed a bid. He started a room. He's a really good guy, and he trades well. So there are some people out there that have a real service to offer, and you know, you can really benefit from it. But you just got to be careful not to follow too many gurus. They're just gonna mix you up, and before you know it, one day you're trading one way and the next day you're trading another way.
Of course, yeah. And I mean, I know some guys on Twitter who are very legitimate traders and have like a few hundred followers. Like, so don't only go off follow account either, because there are some guys who keep a low profile but also make some very decent money. So yeah, solid advice. Let's wrap this up, Mike. If someone wants to find out more about you, where is the best place to go?
So I have a Twitter. I've this year become, actually in 2017, I've become, you know, more active on Twitter. So it's Michael_Katz, KATZ, 11. on Twitter. And then we have our website, sevenpointscapital.com. And I think those are probably the easiest ways to get in touch with us.
Okay. Sounds good, man. Well, I'll make sure to include those links in the show notes. Yeah, I think that's it. So yeah, let's end it there, Mike. I appreciate you doing the chat.
I'd like to say, Aaron, thank you for what you do. The podcast that you've been able to put together over the years are just fantastic. You're able to really tap into some great minds, and I think you're doing a great service for traders. And I recommend to all our traders to follow you and to listen to every one of your podcasts, because I think there's a lot of value out there.
Oh, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
You've reached the end of this episode of Chat with Traders, but rest assured, there are more episodes loaded with real market insight and zero hype on the way soon. So to stay updated with each great new release, subscribe to the podcast in iTunes, and we'd love it if you'd leave a rating and review. We'll catch you next time on Chat with Traders.